Hello, my name is Jill Zamorski, and welcome to Reading and Drinking on the Psalm TV Podcast Network. On today's show, I am going to talk all about a book entitled Bursting Bubbles, A Secret History of Champagne and the Rise of the Grape Growers by Robert Walters. Now, I know this podcast is called Reading and Drinking, and based on the frequency with which I review books about my favorite of the wines, champagne, you might think it should be retitled Reading and Drinking Champagne. But sorry, not sorry. It's such a delicious and complicated and historic and interesting beverage. And there's just a lot of people who write books about it, and I really like reading books about it. But this is a different one. This is has a very specific focus, and so we're going to dive specifically into the wines of one style of producer, the Récolteur Manipulant, or the grower producers. This episode is sponsored by Study Hall, my show on Psalm TV, where you can learn the ins and outs of being a sommelier and get helpful hints and tips for studying for your exams. Not a subscriber? Well, you can get a year of Psalm TV for 50% off with the code STUDYHALL. That's all one word, Study Hall, and you'll get a year's subscription for only $25. So this book, if you go out looking for it, it was published in 2018, so it's pretty recent. I always appreciate that because obviously the world of wine changes quickly. It is a paperback, and it has been reprinted, I think, in hard copy, but I've got the paperback, and it has a cover image. The title is kind of in gold foil, but it's basically a picture of a champagne bottle that's like wrapped up in a paper bag, so you can't see the label. So that's sort of a reference to like a blind tasting. You know, when we're tasting wines and not knowing what they are, we need to cover up the bottle. And so it looks like it's just a bottle of wine in a paper bag. So this is a pretty approachable read. It is about 228 pages, and that does not include like notes and bibliography and epilogue. And the way this book is organized makes for like very digestible little sips, little bites, because it's a series of wine myths, and I'll get to this in a second, specifically regarding champagne, misconceptions, things that will be debunked. And then there's different parts, and there's about 20 different parts, and then there's about 10 different myths that are interspersed between them. And the different parts focus on a combination of something historical, factual, or geographical in the Champagne region, which is super interesting and helpful. And then there are also producer profiles. So the producers, this is like a who's who of like the most culty of the culty grower producers. So the producers are profiled in this book are Jérôme Prévost, François Aigle of Aigle-Aurier, Pascal Agrippard, Anselme Solos of Jacques Solos, Pierre Lamandier of Lamandier-Bernier, Emmanuel Lasagna from Jacques Lasagna, Bertrand Gautierot from Vuet et Sorbet, and then finally Cédric Bouchard with his label Rose de Gênes. So these are all wines, full disclosure, that I have bought, sold, listed on programs that I have run, and consumed. And I've said it a gazillion times. I'll never stop saying it. I love champagne. There's so much diversity in this category of wine. So I was really excited to read this book. A friend of mine who also works in the champagne industry recommended it to me. And it's a really interesting take. From the jump, I was a little suspect. And before I get into it, let me give you just a hot second little backup on the author. He's an Australian author, and he's worked in the wine industry for a long time, for about 25 years. As a wine merchant and a writer and a vineyard owner, and he imports wines, specifically grower champagnes, to Australia. He's written for multiple publications, including World of Fine Wine, and he wrote a series of articles on grower producers, and that was sort of the impetus and the base for this book. So a little background on Robert Walters. So from the jump, I was a little like, not annoyed, but like, oh, this again? Because some of the myths in this book, we've repeated them so many times, right? And they're things like, does putting a silver spoon in a bottle of open champagne keep it from going flat? Pro tip, it doesn't, right? And hey, maybe we'll reach somebody out there who doesn't know this. And I've got to recognize and check myself that these myths, as someone who works in the champagne trade and someone who works in the wine industry writ large, that these are probably things that I'm like, oh God, this again. And I need to remember that some of these myths might still not be understood by the population generally. So it does, I guess, bear repeating. This is a kind of a niche book. And so I would imagine that the intended audience for this book probably knows that most of these myths are in fact just myths and not fact. So one of them, the very first one actually, is about Dom Pérignon. And he is definitely regarded as the spiritual father of Champagne. He was a real life Benedictine monk, and he lived, worked, and died in the late 17th and early 18th centuries. He's entombed at the Abbey of Ovier, where he worked. And the big myth around Dom Pérignon that's been propagated endlessly for decades is that he created champagne. There's a lot that's attributed to him, and a lot of it is not true. and they'll tell you that at Dom Perignon. It's just, I don't know, sometimes like there's good stories and you need a name or a face or something attached to it. And he did not invent champagne. There's no evidence that he was blind. He actually probably spent his entire life while making wine, trying to prevent wine with bubbles. And so that's the first myth. And I saw that and I was like, oh God, this again. But then of course, this is probably some new information for a lot of people. So the book does incorporate some photos. And because it's a relatively recent book, they are pretty high quality. They're black and white, but they are high quality. And there's occasionally some maps and things like that. So there is some definite good factual information. There are some very important few pages in the very beginning where the author details some disclaimers. And I really appreciate this because I formed opinions about this book before I ever cracked the cover. I do that with a lot of books. It's hard to not do that, which is why you have to read the whole thing. And the disclaimers that he puts out there are, number one, this is not a wine guide. So yes, he does talk about the region. He does talk about a style of producer, and then he does profile producers, but this is not intended to be some like comprehensive guide to champagne. This is my favorite. The author is not completely impartial. I would actually take that one step farther and say the author's definitely not impartial. He's got an angle, and that's fine, right? It's completely fine, but it's really important that you know that up front. I'll detail why I think this is so, but when I was thinking about this book and how I wanted to talk about it, you know, if you haven't listened to all previous podcasts, shameless plug, you should. And I did review a book that I think is one of the most impactful and comprehensive and objective books. Peter Leem wrote a book about champagne, and I still think it is one of the most valuable books you could ever have in your collection. I feel like this book, it's such a niche and specific take that it is not a guide, right? And it is very partial. The third disclaimer is that the arguments in this book are the authors and the authors alone. That is also important because when people take a perspective, and in champagne, it's a popular perspective, pitting different styles of producers against each other, and that might be charged language, but there's multiple different styles of producers in champagne, but the two most recognized and most common are the négociant manipulant, or NM is how that's abbreviated on a label. And these are the bigger producers that you're probably familiar with. They're larger and they make more wine and they're more visible. And then the smaller producers, the grower producers, the récoltant manipulant. So they're the farmers who own land and make grapes just from land that they own. Whereas négociants can buy in grapes from land that they just contract or manage. And I feel like the only people that pit these producers against each other are sommeliers and writers. I don't actually know. I mean, I'm not from Champagne, but I don't feel like there's like inherent animosity between these producers. They work in a common region. Their wines, whether you like it or not, fall under a common appellation, and there's tremendous diversity of them. But I do feel that books like this sort of create a little sharks and jets situation. And I'm not entirely sure how accurate that actually is on the ground in Champagne. And then this is my favorite, if I haven't led up to it. Number four, this book should not be viewed as an exercise in grand mark bashing. So the grand marks is another term to describe these négociant manipulant, these large producers, these famous producers. And I'm gonna read something. So this book shouldn't be viewed as an exercise in grand mark bashing. And then there's a little paragraph. Most of Champagne's worst wines are in fact produced by lower grade growers, cooperatives, and small négociants, not by the large houses or grand marks. That's a strong statement right there. But I don't know that the author really backs up that statement throughout this book, because he kind of does, maybe bash isn't the right word, but there's like a little snide, a little snark. There's just ways, you know, a sentence at the end of a paragraph where like, they don't do this there, or this is not how they do this there. So it's not so much bashing, but there's a perspective and it's really important that you understand it from the jump. So this book is based on a series of articles, but it flows really seamlessly, like the author is journeying through the region of Champagne. And there's some really fun, like small details. I always go through these books and like underline things that I want to remember and kind of come back to. And there are, you know, sometimes opportunities for me to learn new things as well. This is a region I visited and I love, and I drink the wines with a great deal of frequency, but I don't know everything about it. And so I do really appreciate when I come across something, I'm like, ooh, that's fantastic. It does officially start in chapter one with the words once upon a time, which is very sweet and cute. And I did actually read this as bedtime reading. I would read like a chapter or a part a night, and you can just knock it out pretty quickly that way. But it is really funny. So it starts off in the beginning of Champagne, right? How Champagne wasn't originally a sparkling wine, and that the historical information is quite accurate. And there's some fun, interesting quotes. And the author does talk about how in the beginning, pre-work of Louis Pasteur, the understanding of fermentation was not, it didn't really exist. And so no one knew what was happening. And bottles were inadvertently sparkling based on, you know, halted and then resumed fermentation in the bottle. He talks about Dom Pérignon's role in this. And it's interesting because this podcast is sort of a back-to-back with another podcast on Champagne book, The Widow Clicquot. And the same terminology is used. And I mean, before they understood the process of second fermentation and controlling fermentation in the bottle with the, you know, yeast consuming sugar, it sounds like the possibility that you would get something nasty, like not just bad, but nasty, was ever present. In fact, it's described here that even if the bottle survived, i.e. didn't explode, the wine itself was often badly affected, sometimes becoming turbid, stinky, and oily. And in the book about the Widow Clicquot, they often, the worry that they were concerned about, because they didn't know how to control or understand fermentation in the bottle, was that the wines might become ropey and slimy. And you just got to wonder, like, what kind of nasty things are happening? Because now, like, you know, you're relatively well assured when you open a bottle of champagne that's going to be clear and sparkling. And I mean, it's not impervious to flaws. And some of the wines from some of the producers in this book that I have had have been flawed. But flaws exist in all wine. And so you hear that and you're like, okay, I've heard this like twice now in two books in a row. Oh, that must have been some rough times. But there's a funny quote that I laughed at. And it's from a person who is a wine merchant named Bertin de Rocheray. And he called sparkling wine an abominable beverage, claiming that bubbles were only proper for beer, drinking chocolate, and whipped cream. I mean, yes, yes, and yes, but also bubbles are proper for wine. And I'm really glad that like the collective wine drinking world has come around to that. And he does talk about how, you know, debunks the myth about how Dom Pérignon worked to prevent sparkling wine. And I think I alluded to this in a previous podcast, how the bubbles that would form when fermentation would recommence in the bottle would just explode bottles in the cellar. And it was really dangerous work. And the cellar workers oftentimes wore like these iron masks. And I'm not sure if I mentioned it in this podcast or a previous one, but when I was visiting Dom Pérignon once, there's a man named Thierry Caviste, and I asked him in French if people had ever died in the cellars, and he gave me a weird look, but he also said yes. And so it's just a reminder that like the history of this wine was a very dangerous one, and science is a very, very good thing, and it certainly has allowed us to enjoy this beverage for going on several centuries now. One of the things that's really important in this book, and there's arguments that I agree with, and then I feel like sometimes the author gets away with those arguments, but he does detail sort of the history in this region and why the Champagne region has, you can't really compare it to other places, how it's kind of grown up differently, how the wines have always been made for, you know, since they've been created intentionally sparkling, made for export, and they've been made in various styles. And Champagne is oftentimes repeatedly in this book and just generally compared to Burgundy, a fine wine producing area not very far away in France. And the author details, and this is an important point, that unlike in the Côte d'Or in Burgundy, monastic orders, so it was Cistercian monks, not the Benedictine order, which is what was in Champagne, they had established the practice of selling wines on the fame of a village or a vineyard from, you know, time immemorial. They had been ruling that system. And so we have established vineyards and famous wine producing villages for centuries longer. Champagne was just not that area. It was not an area where you could produce fine wines. And Peter Lim details this in his book, that it's an inaccurate comparison to look at Champagne and look at Burgundy and be like, they're so close. Why aren't the wines better historically? Or why can't we compare it to Burgundy? And historically, there's a reason why. And by the time Champagne was made intentionally sparkling in the Champagne region, the French Revolution had eradicated the church from that region. So the monks were no longer in charge of that. And when they were in charge of everything, this was not a major commercial area for wine production. So you got to know your history. But then also, again, as Peter details in his book, the terroirs are different. We're not that far away from each other from Burgundy to Champagne, and Champagne's not a tiny area, but they're not the same. And the whole history and the emergence of the style of wine in the region, I think you're kind of setting yourself up for disappointment if you constantly try to compare the two. And who's to say that they should be compared? Like, there's a lot of Champagne lovers who love Burgundy, and that's great. I love both. But I also appreciate the uniqueness of the region of Champagne. And I don't feel that its quality or inherent value needs to hinge on its comparison to another fine wine production or fine wine area of production. Now, every now and then, and I studied French for years, and I can read it and I can kind of write it. My grammar's not great. I can definitely understand it when people are talking to me. But I mean, sometimes you just come across a word and you're not really sure how to pronounce it. And so whenever possible, I like to share that information. I shared last week the correct pronunciation of France, which is, you know, sort of the major metropolitan area in the Champagne region. And in this book, on the way to profile Jérôme Prévost, who is the first grower who's profiled in this book, the author is describing his actual physical journey, traveling from France to Gueux. And the way that town is spelled is G-U-E-U-X. So if you didn't know how it was pronounced, you might call it Gueux. That would be not correct. And he includes a little phonetic pronunciation. So like I said with France, imagine saying France, but say it fancy, France, and then take off the F, France. Feel free to like say it through your nose as if you were French. And he says Gueux is pronounced G-E-R-H, like girl without the L. There you go. So it's just little teeny details, but every now and then you come across something, and I'm pretty sure when I was reading this, I was like, huh, there you go. Like, this is a language that I understand, and I wasn't entirely sure and probably did not pronounce that word, that place correctly. So just little snippets, little nuggets of like good information. Now, when the chapter on the producer, it ranges based on like their philosophy and where they're located and the geographic area and the size of their production. And so the chapters range in length. But one thing I really like, and one of the best things about this book, again, it's only featuring 8 different producers, which is not much considering, you know, there's thousands of growers in Champagne. Not all of them are making their own wine, but there's a lot of them. But anyways, at the end of the chapter on that producer, there's a page or two about their wines. And this is really helpful because this actually includes some technical details, the dates of the first vintage, comparing and contrasting. And so, I mean, I didn't look at each producer's individual website, if they have one, but sometimes, you know, with Champagne, with a lot of European wines, they don't include technical details necessarily on the back. Some producers have gotten very good at this. Ahem, Krug, with the Krug ID, or other producers are putting QR codes. I don't know. I haven't looked, I could go into my cellar, but I haven't looked at the back of some of these bottles. So it is good to get some technical information on these wines, to be sure. There's an interesting inclusion here, and I was deciding whether or not I should talk about it, but the author did, so I'm gonna. And about 60 pages in, when he's visiting François Egli of Egli Aurier, he talks about how there was a renowned French wine writer named Michel Betan, and how he encouraged many of the finest growers and was certainly a key promoter in both the early days of Egli, François Egli, and Anselme Solos, who is profiled in this book, and whose winery, Jacques Solos, is probably one of the most famous grower producers. And this wine writer, Michel Betan, began visiting François Egli in the 1980s, tasting at the Domaine, introduced a lot of people to his wines, and helped promote, you know, these grower producers. Here's where it gets a little interesting. And it's not a bad thing. It's just interesting. So I want to be clear. He encouraged us to seek more ripeness and also encouraged us to consider bottling our terroir separately, Egli says of Betan. On one occasion, he visited and tasted wine from Les Crayères, one of his greatest vineyards, and he was amazed. And he said, I should bottle this wine separately. And I explained to him that it was just Pinot Noir. At the time, straight bottlings of Pinot Noir were unheard of. And he said, and so you bottle a Blanc Noir. There's no problem with that. So we did, as an experiment. And the thing that's interesting about all this is this book very much puts these growers on a pedestal. And a lot of them, their history is relatively recent because while their families might have been land owners and wine growers for a long time, grape growers for a long time, just the enterprise of making and then commercializing champagne is very expensive. It's a technical process and it requires aging. And so that's just not something that all these farmers were necessarily interested in. And so a lot of times their history is relatively recent. You know, we're talking about a region that's been prominent in the world of wine for centuries, and some of these growers have only been around for decades. But it's interesting to me, and there's no snark here, but talking about how there's a lot of some early influence in terms of style and evolution and contacts and promotion was due to the encouragement of an influential journalist, writer. And if that sounds familiar, that's because that happens all the time all over the world. And I'm not saying that there's a Betanization, like there was a Parkerization, but you've got to just stop and recognize that like we put these producers on a pedestal, but sometimes they got there because they were influenced by somebody else. And it's not a bad thing, but maybe it's not this like super pure, like coming from a philosophy that they developed themselves. Winemakers can be influenced. Wine is trendy. Palates and preferences change. And sometimes you can be influenced by a very, very powerful writer. So just a little interesting inclusion. I thought that was kind of neat. Again, while the producer says he doesn't bash the Grand Marks, neither really do any of the growers in this book. There's sometimes some comparison, and the producer actually does detail the fact that he goes and visits Moet and Chandon. And I mean, that's one step up than from what Alice Fiering did in her book when she was willing to dog the wines, but didn't necessarily like visit some of the producers that she was willing to dog. But that's not enough, I guess, in my opinion. The author, he's got a lot of opinions on the large houses, the Grand Marks, as opposed to the growers. But he sometimes omits or sometimes doesn't acknowledge the good work that these large producers are doing. So one of the analogies, and it's talked about in this book, is the analogy I'll explain, but the one focus in this book is on kind of the change in the style of viticulture in the Champagne region. Champagne has a little bit of an embarrassing history. It's a lot of an embarrassing history. Let's call it what it is. Where decades ago, they would import trash from Paris and they would use that essentially as like fertilizer in the vineyards, which sounds ridiculous, right? It was called boue de vie. And you can still see little bits of plastic or glass or whatever in vineyards all over the Champagne region. Now, sometimes this is explained or qualified by saying that decades ago, the trash wasn't as gross as it is now. And that's very possible, but it's still gross, right? City trash used as fertilizer in your vineyards. And a lot of these producers are heralded because they have been making the change to very terroir focused winemaking and, you know, eliminating herbicides and pesticides. And look, that's no small feat in Champagne. It's a very far north marginal growing wine producing region. And there's a million things that can go wrong. There's a fair amount of rain, rot, mold, mildew. It's not uncommon. None of those things is good in finished Champagne and for grapes. And so he lauds these producers for making these changes. But some of these producers are itty bitty teeny tiny, and they've only got a couple of hectares and specific vineyards. And again, not a farmer, not a grower, not a winemaker. It is easier to make that change when you have a much more controlled scope. When you are Moet and Chandon or Veuve Clicquot, the first and the second largest producers in the Champagne region, and you do own your own vineyards, but you're contracting with hundreds of growers throughout the region, things just move a little slower. And sometimes people don't want to hear that. I liken it to turning direction if you are like an aircraft carrier or in a canoe, right? So if you are a small grower, like in a canoe, if you want to change direction, it's real easy. Dip your oar in the water and like turn it and you can change direction pretty quickly, right? You could just stop buying synthetic, you know, inputs and stop, you know, using them in your vineyard. And then next year, boom. Now, if you wanted certification, you might have to wait a few years to turn organic or biodynamic, but you can change pretty immediately because it's very controllable. It just takes things a little bit larger. And I don't think, and look, I've said it before, you guys know who I work for. I don't think it's fair necessarily to, not that we're not applying the same standards, but expect the same speed, the alacrity with which you can change over the style of viticulture from a producer who controls much on orders, many orders of magnitude, much, much more land. It just takes some time. And they're not given credit for the changes that they do make, where, you know, their largesse has contributed and benefited the entire region. A lot of the producers in this book do utilize oak casks, but it was Moet and Chandon that introduced stainless steel tanks to the region of Champagne. And now, like, the vast majority of people use them for fermentation. That's winemaking. That's not viticulture. But when a large producer, and I'm not just talking about the LVMH producers, I'm talking about Tattenjay or Louis Roederer or Laurent Perrier. When one of those large producers, when one of the Grand Marks makes a change, like eliminating herbicides or setting a goal for 2021 or 2022 or 2023 to make positive changes across all of their holdings, that should be applauded because they have the ability to change. Their change they have the ability to affect is so much greater. It just might not happen quite as fast. And the author ignores all that. And I feel that it's worth making that point, that it's great. And I'm not dismissing any of the good work that any of these producers are doing. I'm just saying that they're a little bit more nimble. And so props to them. They should. Perhaps we should have been holding them to a higher standard. Perhaps when these growers are talking about how just mere decades ago they were farming conventionally and using all of the synthetic inputs, maybe we should turn a specific magnifying glass on them and saying, why weren't you doing this sooner? And that's because no one recognized that that was the way to do things. That was the trend of the time. Everybody was farming that way. And people have become, they've seen the light, they've gotten more enlightened. And some, it just takes a little bit longer, but there's reasons for that, not excuses for that. Anyway, that's my soapbox. So I'll get off that there. Now it is, as we go through the different producers, starting with Jérôme Provost and then Aigle Orier, the third producer is Pascal Agropar. And it was funny when I was reading this book, it was kind of not intentional, but like good timing. My birthday was last month. and I was out with some friends. And shout out to one of my favorite destinations for champagne drinking in Chicago, Pops for Champagne. Woo woo. It's a restaurant and champagne bar. I mean, that's what their wine list is dedicated to, all sorts of champagnes. And I did, in fact, actually enjoy a bottle of champagne from Pascal Agrapart, the Avisoise. And it was delicious. It's a Blanc de Blanc. And it was so fun because I had just had that recently with friends. And then I get to this chapter. And look, when I'm out tasting wine or drinking wine with friends, we all do this. Sometimes we taste academically and we're thinking about exactly what we're tasting and what we know of this producer and what we know of this wine and what we're tasting in it. And sometimes we're just passively enjoying things and both are completely okay. So at that time, I was passively enjoying it. It was delicious and I enjoyed every sip. But then it was very fun to like come across the book talking about Pascal Agrapart and then like get a little bit of detail on the wine that I had been enjoying. I was like, hey, check this out. Like, it's a Blanc de Blanc. It comes from two adjacent vineyards. And it was just, you know, some stuff you can infer from the label, but it was kind of nice to get a little bit more, I guess, intel as I was going along. This is what I was saying. It's a powerful Blanc de Blanc, 100% Chardonnay from two clay-rich vineyards, Les Robards and Lavoie d'Epernay, that sit next to each other on the slopes of Avise. There you go. That's what I drank for my birthday, and it was delicious. So as the book keeps going, you know, back and forth between different styles of producers and then kind of detailing their wine, one of the, I guess there's a couple of things that I, again, contrasts or maybe inconsistencies. There is a very thorough discussion of dosage, which is the addition of champagne, the addition of sugar once the champagne has finished its aging and has been clarified. And it can be either to create balance in the wine or to create intentionally sweet style. Not surprisingly, because the trend currently is to go after very, very dry wines, a lot of these producers bottle wines with very little dosage or none sometimes. And the author very objectively talks about the role of dosage and how sometimes it can be very helpful to create balance in the wine. But there is a commonality in these producers that they're seeking like a great deal of ripeness in the vineyard already. And so they don't necessarily need to find that balance with dosage. I would argue that another mitigating circumstance is global climate change. And so it's not just growers pushing for extra ripeness and hang time. It's the fact that it's just easier for everyone to achieve balance in the vineyard with warmer temperatures. But he does kind of dog on dosage and talks about the history and how people were doctoring up their wines. Also, that's what the clientele demanded. People just had a sweet tooth and they wanted really, really sweet wines. So give the people what they want. Is that a bad thing? I don't know. And in the section on Jacques Salos, there is a very extended kind of detail on his wines. And they go through all of his different wines. The author will say, hey, this particular wine. And then Salos talks about the wine specifically in terms of its technical data and then his impression of it. And despite all of the kind of relative dogging about the idea of dosage and maybe like the looking down one's nose at the historical reasons for it, on page 132, in his conversation with Jacques Salos, the author asks about a cuvée called Exquise or Exquise. And this is a sec style champagne. Sec means dry, and it's actually sweeter than Brut, which is dry champagne. And it's an unusual wine. It spends 5 years on its lees, and it is dosed between 20 and 24 grams per liter of residual sugar. A Brut champagne can have somewhere between 0 and 12. So this is about twice as sweet as the maximum sweetness level of a dry champagne. It's a very expensive bottle. I think it costs like at least $300. I've never had it. I like sec and demi-sec champagnes. They're not a terribly common style that we see because that's just not what people are into these days. But it just was funny that there's a fair amount of attention paid to the negative side of dosage. And then when one of the most revered grower producers is making an intentionally sweeter style of wine, there's no discussion of it whatsoever. There's no kind of magnifying or looking into like, what are you using for dosage? What type of sugar? Why are you even making this? Does the sugar obscure the terroir? Which is what a lot of arguments about dosage say, is that you're just trying to cover something up. But when the disciple does it, there's no question. And I saw that and I was like, that's interesting. So this book is full of contrast. There's great information. There is really insightful producer profiles and lots of good intel on their specific producers, but there's an angle and there's a slant. The author talks repeatedly about how one of the most important things with these producers is how they're bottling single parcel wines. So they're bottling wines from grapes that are just grown in one particular vineyard. And this is atypical for Champagne generally, because this is a region that has historically relied on blends of different grapes from different vineyards, from different villages, and from different subregions in Champagne. That's not a bad thing. He does not support the idea, which most people in Champagne do, that historically this was done to create a better wine as a result. And I think Peter Lehm kind of backs that up. All terroirs are not equal. And so if you can get, you know, good wines from different places and you can make a better wine by blending them together, do it. Don't compare it to Burgundy. It's not fair. It's not the same place. Yeah, they don't do that in Burgundy unless they're making like a Bourgogne Rouge or a Passe du Grand. That's fine. This is Champagne. It's not Burgundy. I don't get so precious about that. But then there's no mention of Grand Marque producers who are doing really specific things, like Krug, for example, who vinifies plot by plot. And every single plot of grapes, whether it's a parcel from a vineyard or from a vineyard, those wines are crushed and fermented and vinified individually. And so they have all these very unique terroirs. And Krug invites their growers to taste the finished wine, something that the author says never happens. It's not true. It does happen, right? And so I just think that with the angle of this book, sometimes some of the realities of the region are maybe a little bit obscured. Not necessarily intentionally, not malintentionally. It just sometimes there's a little bit of obfuscation or maybe just ignoring certain characteristics. So what works in this book? Well, lots of stuff. I learned new things. I learned pronunciations. I got a great informative deep dive on producers who I, like I said, have bought, sold, junk, listed. And it's a good read. It's entertaining. I mean, I love Champagne and I haven't been there in a couple of years. And so I like reading about people traveling through the region. It just makes me feel a little bit closer to it. It's very well written. What doesn't work? I mean, some small snippy things. Obviously, the author has a perspective. That's not something that doesn't work for me. It's just something that you need to understand. Occasionally, and this happens with lots of Champagne books, there's just little things like, you know it, variety and varietal, or calling what was long time known as Pinot Meunier. Now we call it correctly Meunier. And in this book, it's just referred to as Pinot Meunier. And that's just not as accurate or as current as we know in the world today of wine. And then oftentimes in Champagne, historically, there was a ranking of the villages in the region. It's called the Echelle des Crus, or the Ladder of Growths. And the book details the reasons for that. It's defunct now. Most books on Champagne will detail the reasoning for it. But it differs from Burgundy because it ranks whole villages as Grand Cru, Premier Cru, or Regular Cru, whereas Burgundy, the region that Champagne is always compared to, their ladder of growths is based on individual vineyards. And when talking about Champagne, that's one thing that it's just inadvertently a misspeak that people do all the time as they talk about Grand Cru vineyards when it's really villages or Premier Cru vineyards. They're vineyards within a Premier Cru or Grand Cru village, but the vineyards themselves are not classified. So little like super minutiae that I just noticed, but nothing glaring. It's a well-written book. It's kind of funny and it's very informative. So for my rating, so I thought long and hard about this and I think, and it has nothing to do with, you know, my perspective on Champagne, but I think that this book is a solid borrow. And here's why. It's really good. And I think that if a book gets rated a borrow, it means I think you should read it. I think you should read this book. This is not the end-all be-all book on Champagne. There are others out there. It is a very good supplemental text. But I think while there's so much good information in this book and on these producers, I think one of the things that's frustrating for me is this argument, the common argument for a lot of people who promote growers and inadvertently or not sort of dismiss the Grand Marques. It's a little bit of, it's an argument that's based on seeking quality and terroir, but I think beneath it all, there's an elitism that I don't enjoy. And so some of these producers, the Champagne region is responsible for about 300 million bottles of production annually. It's a big area of production. Some of these producers bottle like 10 or 15,000 bottles annually. There's not enough Champagne from these 8 producers for the world. And when you start hyping up a certain style of producer with limited production as the best, there's a, in my mind, a little bit of a coded message that like, you should like these and you should not like those. And not everybody has access to these wines. They're expensive. They're really unapologetically expensive sometimes. Joxelos, I'm looking at you. It's totally fine, but they're really expensive bottles. And I am a generalist. I think that there's enough wine for everybody. And also, I think not everybody has the same palate. If the only Champagne out there that was deemed worthy of consumption was from these small grower producers, that means the most of the world wouldn't get Champagne. And I just, it's a little snooty, it's a little elitism. And I think that also drink what you want and drink what you like. And there are very specific profiles with some of these wines, some that some people might not like. And because they're lauded and heralded, people think that they should spend $500 on a bottle, and then they get it and it tastes a little cidery and a little oxidative, and they wonder why. That might not be their jam. It might not be my jam. And that's fine too, right? There's wine out there for all of us. So I guess I'm like the great egalitarian when it comes to champagne consumption. I think you should drink what you want. I think that you should understand the region because it's diverse and plentiful. And there's enough out there for all of us, maybe not of some of these wines, but there's enough champagne generally for all of us. But I don't think that there should be any feeling that, you know, you should drink these wines because it's cool and this is the best of the best. This is just a style of producer. And they do make some very, very, very good wines. I'd be happy to drink most of the wines that are profiled in this book. It's just that that's not the only great champagne out there. And it's important to recognize when you read a book with a very specific perspective, that that is just the author's perspective and it's not a prescription. So there you go. I hope that qualified why I think this is a borrow and not necessarily a buy. It's a great supplemental read. If you are a lover of champagne like me, I think this is an important book to understand. It'll give you great insight and it will increase your knowledge generally. But it is not, you know, if you're not like me and you don't want a shelf on your bookshelf just full of champagne books, then maybe you don't have to add this to your collection permanently. So thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. Go pop a bottle. Be sure to subscribe. And if you like what you heard, leave us a rating. We'll see you next week. This episode was brought to you by Study Hall, my show on Somm TV, where you can learn the ins and outs of being a sommelier and get helpful hints and tips for studying for all your exams. Get a year of Somm TV for only $25 with the code STUDYHALL.